obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, my name's Kansas. I'm an alcoholic.
Kansas.
This is in airplane mode. I'm not texting. This is a timer for your protection. Sobriety date is July 2nd, 1996. I sort of have two home groups, the Carlsbad AA Workshop and then the Sunset Group, both in Oceanside and Carlsbad. But I think I'm going to join the Wednesday night women's, what is this called? Ladies Night Out. I think that sounds like a... I'd like to help some people there. My wife's in the back of the room. I'm going to pay for that later. You can come too, honey. But anyway, I want to thank Jason and the Southern California Convention Committee. This has been... I've spoke at a couple of conventions now, not very many. Usually when I've spoken AA, it's because I kind of came up the last, you know, the sort of 10 years of it, you know, in grown up AA, they say, oh yeah, would you like some gas money for reimbursement for driving, you know, 10 miles past any lengths? And it's sort of this foreign concept if you ever did young people's AA where we're like, okay, we're going to Reading tonight and you're going to speak at our camp out. And, you know, and so you get up there and when you get to Reading, it's torrential rains. So a few of you sort of throw, you know, that you're all making, you know, $12 an hour and everybody sort of pulls together enough money. And I remember staying in the Thunderbird Lodge. And this place, I'm telling you, I have never seen a more alcoholic motel in my entire life. There was, you know, the beer bottle openers you see on the side of a cooler in some of these little gas stations? There was one you could reach for on the wall from the toilet. I'm telling you, Redding, California is a place to die of alcoholism. I was not surprised that they have good Alcoholics Anonymous up there. I want to thank our first two speakers. I got to be on an AccuPaw host committee. I know that David is chairing the AccuPaw host committee today. The first thing I said to him is, are you going to shoot your phone when this is all done? For any of you guys that don't know, AccuPaw is the All California Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous Convention. I know in our year of hosting it, we had 2,700 people show up in San Diego. We'll see if you guys can catch up to that record that we set. Because we had just beat Orange County's of only a mere 2,675. I'm giving him a hard time. He knows this and he loves this. I can't tell you sort of what, you know, you're sort of this idea of herding cats that putting on one of those conventions is. And for everything to come together, because it's not like you have a year in and year out tradition of hosting this convention. You have a year in and year out attempt to secure this convention and to get enough young, suicidal, almost dead kids together enough to host a convention. And I say that, but I know when we were putting on, we had to put on a bid skit to get our convention, and the girl I had written the bid skit with was in the back of the room just coming back from a 5150 in a hospital where she had had a suicide attempt, and she was in tears seeing it, because while we were practicing this skit week in and week out trying to get ready to get this convention, she was drinking and she was falling apart, and she was in the back of the room in tears because she was seeing the miracle. She was seeing the miracle happen. You know, this was what, you know, sitting in my living room we had come up with. And I have some really treasured memories from young people's AA. I call myself, I'm in retirement paw. There are some people these days claiming oldie paw. I refuse the handle. I'm 37 years old. I will not accept old as part of my title. I'm no longer as involved with young people's AA as I once was. I've been enriched by it, and I want to mention that, and I don't want to fail to mention that because of the nature of this particular speaker meeting. I had the opportunity to participate in the Southern California H&I convention. I got the I had the opportunity to be published by the Grapevine, to be to have my story selected to be in a book that the Grapevine published. I got to interact with trustees. I got to interact with the General Service Board. There, every layer of Alcoholics Anonymous I was exposed to, interacted with, and served with through serving on this little podunk committee of the North San Diego Young People in AA. And, you know, I was at area committee meetings on a monthly basis. I was at area assemblies. I was participating in all facets of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was being exposed, and I was getting involved with the concepts, traditions, and steps of our fellowship in a way that I could not have done in a lot of the other groups that I belong to, because we're not going to let the 18-year-old be responsible to be our general service rep. The 18-year-old who's 60 pounds underweight, who weighs 133 pounds when he walks in here, who has blood coming out of his lungs, we're not going to let him represent us at the assembly. You know, that wasn't going to happen yet in my groups. And I ended up with these wonderful opportunities through Young People's Service, and I'm very, very grateful for it. And I don't want to fail to say that as I get into my story. So, and thank you, David, for your service. I can only imagine the drama and BS you've put up with this year. And that is no joke if you've ever been on one of these committees to know. I have a sponsor that is a former member of the General Service Board, who is also a former chair of the ACCUPAW host committee. And he told me that it was the hardest position in Alcoholics Anonymous he ever served in. One of the most rewarding, but the most difficult and the most work intensive. So I want to give you a round of applause. I expect $20 after the meeting for that. Okay. I was born in a manger. There were three wise men there. I was born in Massachusetts. My mother's 16 years old when she had me. I was her second child. She had a third child at 18. So by 18, she'd had three children. We all had different fathers. My oldest brother, who I did not meet until about 2 years ago, was put up for adoption. My sister, who was born after me, had a condition called spina bifida, meant that her spine was open and underdeveloped. She was for someone with a neural tube defect, she was actually very fortunate and was able to walk for a good part of her life. But that was when you have I didn't meet my father. He was gone by the time I was out. So this was you have this sort of, here's the start, you know. And so I was born in Massachusetts, lived in Rhode Island when I was a kid, and my sister's father was horrendously abusive. That was my earliest memories are of domestic violence. In my home. Those are the first memories I have, are of my mother on her back being beat by a big man. So we ran away to Kansas, and that's where the moniker comes from. So we ran away to Kansas when I was a kid, and I ended up going to school there and watching my mother's alcoholism progress, watching it progress into a methamphetamine addiction. She actually went to treatment when I was about 10 or 11 years old for alcoholism and came out a meth addict. She was one of the people that the treatment center actually made her worse. She went there and found a boyfriend instead of found God. And this is what he was into, so she was just codependent enough to follow suit. And so I spent many of the next years living in and out of methamphetamine labs and sort of having that lifestyle around me. My first drink was at about 13, 14 years old. Little hard to recollect. I wasn't planning on being your speaker today at the time, but what had happened was that I had gone through many years making this promise that I was never going to drink. I am never going to do. I don't want to be what these people were. I had been neglected. I'd been beat. I had grown up in poverty. To give you an idea, probably my least favorite home that we ever lived in. We'd had this sort of wonderful summer. We had moved to this new house, and it was sort of out of the, you know, we had been living in a lot of these places where everybody's on top of each other, and, you know, it was just bad, you know, sort of what you picture. But then we found this one house. It was in a rundown neighborhood, but it was in a, it, it, we had a field. sort of around the house, and it kind of gave us a buffer from the neighborhood we were in. And we had a 55-gallon drum that was in the yard when we moved in, and so we took the little grate out of the stove, and we made a grill out of it, and we were collecting wood from the neighborhoods and the woods nearby, and we made a barbecue out of it, and we collected neighborhood dogs, and we had this, like, really wonderful summer. And then the winter came, and the pipes froze, and the toilet didn't flush through the entire winter. There was no plumber. There was a bottle of bleach. That was how we maintained in the house. Now, something else that happens when you live in a field and the winter comes and you live in a house like this is that the mice come. And we had mice and rats come into the house, and I don't mean we had a few mice and a few rats. I mean you get to a certain level and vermin no longer run and hide. They're no longer afraid of you. They've taken over. And they come over you while you're sleeping. You feel them in the bed with you. And when you're a kid, this is a horrible and disgusting feeling, and you never want ever to do this, because while I had an idea that we were having to live like this because of the illness my mother suffered from. You know, I didn't understand why she didn't love us. That's what was going on in my head. Why doesn't she love us? Why does she do this to us? Why doesn't she just pull it together? She's worked before. Why can't she do it now? Okay. I'm never going to do that to somebody. How do you do that to somebody? And then the day came that I took my first drink. I forgave her. I knew why she had done it. I knew why she had done it. Because everything that was ever wrong with me was fixed. Not permanently. I knew it would be back, but it was fixed for now. I knew that I had an answer. I had a solution, that things were going to be okay. I had somewhere to turn. I had somewhere to turn when I felt like me. And so I started to turn into it as often and as regularly and as much as I could, you know, which for me was right out of the gate day to day, you know, every single day. And like a lot of our other speakers, you know, that was, I had hobbies in addition to alcohol. I'm unapologetic about having done drugs to AA members. I'm not going to use, we didn't hand out secret AA decoder rings at the door, so I'm not going to blanket the word drugs with something like outside issues. There are lots of outside issues that you guys talk about when you talk about your depressions, your marriages, and things like that. And frankly, the thing is, those aren't outside issues. When I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, "Do you have a drinking problem?" I said, "You bet." They said, "Come on in, kid, and bring all the rest of your problems with you, too." They didn't screen me out. And so the part that was most important for me in relating to others was that I understood what they were saying. I had to understand their language. If I went into a meeting and they were so lost in AA speak that they could only understand one another because they were people pleasing an old timer in the room who had one idea of how things should be done, I might have died. But the fact is, somebody in the room was talking plain and simple, and they were telling the truth, and they were talking from the heart, and I understood them because the language of the heart was one that I didn't need an interpretation manual for. And I found it in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found it from this man named Kelly. Kelly came into the, because I walked into an emergency room when I was 18 years old. I'd been in foster care for 3.5 years. I had taken my paperwork coming out of foster care. They say, because they can extend, this is a little known fact, but they can extend your, be it a ward of the court until you're 21 if you're still in foster care, if you're having problems when you turn 18. And so they didn't know that I had about my problems. They knew I had a lot of criminal problems. They knew that I needed to stay in state custody for those problems, but I'd managed to keep them out of my hair for just long enough that I was able to get out of state custody, and I still had the papers in my hand when I walked into the ER and asked them for help. But so I went to the local free treatment program, and I went to the local free halfway house, and then I went to a sober living home that I could pay for with my, you know, with my $4.25 an hour job at Baskin Robbins. You know, I was assistant manager. This was a big deal. Being assistant manager meant that I got a few more hours than the next guy, you know. And you know what? Moving into that sober living, that was the place that I could afford to go to. You know, I couldn't afford to go out and get my own apartment. Sober living was my only choice. There was no other place to go. I could have gone back to the streets, or I could have gone back and done something else. And I'm really grateful for that today. I've worked with a lot of young men in Alcoholics Anonymous that... they know they have other choices. They know they have other choices, and so they sort of throw in the fights. all of the different fights that we have. And you know, they're it's almost like, you know, if you go to nice enough treatment programs, you go to nice enough sober livings, you know, it's like, why stay sober? You know, if I relapse once a year, if I'm 22 years old and I relapse once a year and I get to go back to a $5,000 a month sober living home, God, that beats growing up. Why would I grow up? Why would I get a job? Why would I keep a job? Why would I go out and become a man? I don't understand. Now I know that several of them do, but I have a hard time based on what my experience was. And my experience was going to the food bank to make sure that I could eat in early recovery. My experience was, for the first 10 years of my sobriety, spending a good portion of it on the bus, you know, taking the transit district so I could get to work, so that I could get to court, so I could tie up my court obligations. You know, when I came in here, I had...
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
At 15 years old, I got a Grand Theft Auto. My friend and I we clocked in at night, right about 11 o'clock. We clocked in. All of our buddies who had curfews had gone home by then, so we used all their drugs and alcohol, and then we went out for the night because we had a commission-based job as thieves. And the more hours you work, the better the commission is. You know, I mean, you only get paid if you find something. So we're out running around one night, gallivanting, finding something to do, and we're in this neighborhood that we're not having particularly good luck in, and we come across this car that has keys in the ignition, and we say, let's drive over to the, you know, let's go across the tracks over there to this neighborhood where they have nice car stereos. And we get into the car, we start this thing up, and poor Betty White, that was her name, believe it or not, the owner of the car, I only know that from the court documents, poor Betty White had left her keys in the ignition overnight, probably carrying in her groceries, you know, wishing somebody had helped her carry them in. But we got out to the car, out to the street, and we said, you know, I haven't ever been on vacation. My buddy says, you know, I've never been on vacation, and I was just thinking I'd like to go on vacation. So we decided we're going to go to Florida. We're in Kansas. So we hatched a plan. And if you're a good alcoholic, hatching a plan is important. And you know, in my experience, and this applies to sober young men too, that the more of us you get together, the more our collective IQ decreases. This is true of non-alcoholic young men too. I live right next to a Marine Corps base. There are non-alcoholic young men getting dumber just as you add men to the group. And I was no exception to this. And my IQ took a real dip that night. And we decided that we were going to drive to Clearwater, Florida. We had a friend down there who had moved there, and he had a friend who chopped cars. We were going to go down there. We were going to get this car chopped. Neither one of us was particularly keen on crack cocaine. I don't understand crack. You spend a bunch of money, and 15 minutes later, you're broke, jonesing, and pissed off. And I just don't get that. I'm a little more economical, so I liked, you know, alcohol and meth, and you know, these things that were, you know, that got you a little further. But whatever, a lot of people like crack. And I'm not as likely to use all of it if we go and get all this. So we're going to go to Florida because we had just watched Scarface too, and so we were going to go down there. We were doing our say hello my little friend interpretations, which were not very good. They still aren't. But you know, we're going to go down there and get all this cocaine. We're going to come back to Topeka, Kansas, and we're going to turn it into crack, and we're going to become the kingpins of crack cocaine in Topeka, Kansas. Now, this is all predicated on the fantasy that a 1986 Mercury Topaz is worth something. So, Clearwater, Florida Police Department hit the ground. That was how that story ended. I was extradited back. That's a federal felony for crossing state lines in a stolen car. A few months later, I was arrested for home invasion. One of my friends had been beat up in a house, and we were all drinking, and... he was at some house party, came back, says, I got beat up, I got jumped by these guys. He really got beat up in the bathroom by one guy, we later found out, but of course I got jumped. And so we're all just drunk enough to, you know, we're drunk enough to be invincible. So we go back over to this house, we kick the door in, we find that the party's over. There's one guy there, probably wasn't even at the party. He's passed out upstairs in the house. He gets maced, and we wake him up. I hit him with a baseball bat. My other friends start hitting this man, and this is me at 15 years old. This is just before going into foster care. He jumped out the second story window and escaped us. Now, there's a there's a point where my sponsee usually says something like, I'm going to make a living amends. And I pull out that story, and I say, no, you're not, because I made direct amends to that man. I made direct amends to that man, and he didn't know who I was because he had mace in his eyes. You know, I had to be willing to face that man. I had to be willing to find out that he was a pacifist, you know, just so I could feel a little more guilty in my sobriety. You know, let me wake a pacifist up in a drunken stupor that's a total stranger and do this to him. But, you know, when I'm walking out of there, you know, my friends are high-fiving each other, and I'm in there with them doing it, and I'm doing it too, and we're telling each other how tough we are. But the fact is, I'm walking away from it, and I'm feeling like, I hope I didn't really hurt that guy. That's what's really going on inside of me. I'm not who I present to be. I'm not who I want you to think I am. I just want you to like me. Please like me. Well, he knew somebody's name. We got arrested that night. I sat there getting questioned by the police all night. Another drunken fiasco. My foster parents come to pick me up from the police station, and they walk me past them, and, you know, it's like I've got a good thing. My foster family was not a bad thing. You know, I went from Raised by Wolves to the Beaver Cleaver family. You know, I felt like an alien with these people, but they were loving and normal. And don't give me, after the meeting, some song and dance about there not being any normal people just because you're not normal. These guys were normal, are normal, and continue to be normal, and they've always been normal. I assure you, I lived with them. I'm not normal. I felt like an alien when I moved in with these guys, and it was. But I knew that I was loved, and I knew that I was cared for. And I'll tell you, if love was enough to cure my disease, it would have done it right then and there. If having food, if having clothes on my back was enough to cure this disease, it would have all happened right then and there. It would have all been taken care of. That had nothing to do with it. The fact is, when I pick up a drink, I don't know when I'm going to put down my last drink. The fact is, I'm probably going to put down my last drink because I'm asleep. That's how I'm going to stop. You know, that's what's going to happen to me usually when I pick up a drink. Now, for alcohol, I've never had wine that's seen a grape. I always have a hard time with some of the speakers that come in, and they've had fine wines and things like that. When you get sober at 18 years old, Mad Dog 2020 is your business. Hey, Banana Red will keep you warm at night. Grain alcohol, 190 proof, is one of mine because I don't like the burn. Now, I know that seems counterintuitive because I don't like the burn. I never liked the burn. I know that's not a popular position in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's my position. And I want to get it over with quick. So I'm going to go for the strongest stuff that I can so that I can get this over with fast. Now, I'm walking down the stairs in the police department. I'm walking past them, and I'm looking at my foster mother, and she's giving me that look that a lot of you guys have gotten from somebody, whether it was your spouse, your kids, your family. And the look that she's given me is, I'd crawl on concrete till my fingernails fell off for you, but I know it wouldn't make a damn bit of difference. She's starting to get it. She's starting to get that thing that Al-Anon tries to slowly and gently teach our loved ones. She's starting to get that thing that she can't fix me. That I'm going to have to see this thing through. She didn't say a word that day, but I saw it. And I didn't want her to give up. Now, I don't think that she associated all of this necessarily with my illness or my disease. But I cleaned up all the criminal behavior that day because I didn't want to lose what was going on there. I didn't want to lose having clothes on my back and food in my stomach. I didn't want to lose having some stability for the first time in my life. I didn't quit drinking, though. And I got worse. See, something major, something significant happened that day. Before that, I'd been rebellious, and I'd been waving my middle finger in the air, and nobody could stop me, and F you, if you tried. But something different happened that day as I started to try. And what followed was I became pathetic. Because I started to fail. Over and over and over again, what I started to learn from my experience was that I was a failure. I did not understand it was because I was sick. I did not understand it was because I had a spiritual illness that I could not fix, that I was trying to treat with alcohol. I didn't understand that. And so what I thought was happening was that I was just not good enough at anything and that I was going to continue to fail. I didn't know that if I stopped drinking, for good and for all that I'd get a master's degree someday. I didn't know that. I didn't have a freshman in high school education. I stopped going to school after the eighth grade. That's where I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I finished my master's degree. That was what I was doing on the bus all those years. I was going to school and I was going to AA meetings. I was continuing to serve in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doing what you guys taught me how to do. You know, I was making mistakes along the way. I wasn't doing it perfect. None of us are. But I was continuing to do it, and I was continuing to try. But all of a sudden here in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying started to matter. It started to work out because now I had power that I didn't have before. I was trying to do it in a time and place in my life where I had no power. I was completely powerless over my life, and my life could not be managed. It could not be managed. Not by you, not by me, not by anybody. Outside forces couldn't manage it. You know that your life is unmanageable when all sorts of outsiders start trying to manage it for you. Loved ones, parents, parole officers, probation officers. These are all managers. These are all society's attempts to manage the tornado that is my life. Social workers. None of them can do it. My life was still unmanageable. My disease was bigger than all of them. I needed something great, not just greater than me, but greater than all of them. Greater than every single one of them, and greater than all of them cumulatively, if I was ever going to recover from this thing. I mean, I do want to tell one story that gives you an idea of my family of origin. I, too, have experienced psychosis after not sleeping, like our first 10-minute speaker. Now, one thing that I experienced with this is that the behavior you're engaged in just prior to entering a psychotic break greatly influences the nature of the psychotic break. Now, after drinking and staying awake for about 7 days, I climbed under a blanket with a flashlight in the Book of Revelations. Tactical error on my part. I realize this now. By the end of the conversation, I was alone. I had decided I was Jesus Christ. I had been told, actually. So I've done enough H&I. I've been around the Nut Hut. Most people that think they're Jesus Christ are kind of grandiose about it. Most of them are seeking disciples and followers and other people to bring into this little delusion that they've got going on. I felt burdened, a little put upon, to be honest with you. I didn't particularly want the job. My resume did not support it. I was already a failure. Now you're going to give me this chore. I'd been an atheist the day before, so I'm a little confused by the whole thing too. So I got to sort some things out. So like all tough guys do, I went to talk to Mommy. So I said, "Mom, this is what happened. I think I might be Jesus Christ." The tears start pouring down her face. I'm 16 years old when this happens. She looks at me and she says, "I've always wondered if you were." This is where I come from. This is what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Going back and forth, there's my wife and my one-year-old son. Hey, there's a little boy inside that stroller. He already has more parenting than I received. You know, I am giving that boy love. I am going to be in his life. I met my father when I was 19 years old. I was a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knocked on his door and I introduced myself to him. He went from there and found another son that he had abandoned and introduced himself to him. You know, there's a ripple effect of the wonderful things that happen in this fellowship. He goes to see that son in a prison cell 2 to 4 times a month. It's the only way he's ever seen him. Maybe the only way he ever does see him. But he continues to go. You know, we just went out to a family reunion for his side of the family last month. I wanted my son to meet his great-grandmother. And you can imagine the kind of emotions and feelings that I had sitting there watching this extended family interact that I didn't know, that was denied to me. watching an overall dysfunction but loving family that I never had, watching my uncles and my aunts and my cousins and all these people that have known each other all their lives. And I'm watching this unfold. And there are a lot of feelings that come with that. That doesn't go away because you join Alcoholics Anonymous. That doesn't, I have forgiven him, but it doesn't mean that those feelings aren't there, that I don't experience something there. But what Alcoholics Anonymous has done is it's given me the ability to tolerate those feelings so that I don't have to steal a grandfather from that little boy. So I don't have to steal a great-grandmother from that little boy. So I don't have to steal cousins from him. So I don't have to take from him what was taken from me just because I can't deal with my crap. Because when I came here, I couldn't deal with my crap. You guys, through steps and through this program, have taught me how to deal with my crap. Doesn't mean I don't still make it. I make crap. I make it. You know, there are no saints around here. This is not a Well People's Anonymous program. I haven't gotten this thing down pat just because I got to stand up here. Just my turn in the barrel, I'll tell you. I've gotten my turn on the AA chopping block too. And if you're ever that guy, I feel for you, and we can talk, and I'll tell you, stay in another round, because it's not going to end. It doesn't have to end there. You know, there are times in my sobriety where my sponsor has looked over at me and he said really nice things to me, like, Kansas, you don't have to get drunk to start over in AA. Not your favorite thing to hear, but life-saving words for an alcoholic like me, who to drink is to die. You know, I have not picked up a drink since joining Alcoholics Anonymous. Through my own self-centeredness and through what life has brought me, come about 8 years sober, I get a call that my sister's husband walked into her home and shot and killed her. Shot her through the hand, did this in front of my 4-year-old niece, kidnapped her. They did Amber Alerts. They found him 3 states away in under 24 hours, and he shot himself in front of my niece. 3 months later, my sister with spina bifida died hospital negligence. My former roommate, who I had shared a sobriety date with, died of DTs, same time. Man who went to 4 or 5 meetings a week with me was one of the ones who reacted bad to Vioxx. He was one of my AA guys that I looked up to, one of the older men that I looked up to and that I sought some paternity in. You know, this is what's happening. My grandfather and my grandmother died within the same week. This is all within 6 months that this happens. You know, I'd never experienced loss before. I'd never experienced death before in my life. Not family death. Not like this kind of death. I'd known other people. I'd known alcoholics and addicts that had died. I'd known things like that, but not like this. And I'd certainly not known it sober, and I hurt. And I went to our Thursday night Carlsbad meeting is a dress up meeting. It's a suit and tie meeting. It's a very we've got a lot of old timers in it. They like it run a certain way. I'm in this meeting, and the speaker that night has 45 years of sobriety. He made every old timer in the meeting so angry. I don't think he drank at all, but he did a lot of heroin. I mean, a lot of heroin. I don't think the guy ever took a drink his whole life, but he had 45 years of sobriety, so the old timers didn't quite know whether to try. I mean, like, because this is a meeting, you do that, you know, you might get cut off, you know, but this guy's got 45 years, you know, and so he's just, I mean, you should have heard Denny's after the meeting, you know, we're at Denny's after the meeting judging the speaker, like, you guys are going to do it, you know, during, like, your snack time after this. and they're, I mean, and now all the old timers are ready to kill this guy. But I'll tell you what, I don't care who else was in that room that night. He was sent there by God for me, because he looked out at the room, and the room had as many or more people than are in this room right now, and everybody went away, and he looked straight at me, and he said, sometimes, kid, you got to sit still and hurt. Because I wanted, when I had all this pain going on, I wanted to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous alcoholically. I wanted to know what page number to read. I wanted to know how many commitments I needed. I wanted to know which meeting to switch up. Am I not calling my sponsor 3 times a week enough? Is God punishing me by taking everybody from me because I don't have enough sponsees? What do I have to do in the Rubik's Cube of my Alcoholics Anonymous program to make me not hurt today, right now, in this minute, now? And he had the answer. You don't get that, kid. You got to sit still and hurt. You know? And since then, you know, I've taken that lesson. I've given it to some new men, and the way that I give it is, you're going to have to experience some discomfort if you want to stay here. You don't get to just stay sober and have all the pain go away. We've given up that right. And it doesn't mean that your life is going to be suffering. My life has not been suffering. I'm a business owner right now. You know, I've got a son right now. I've got another one on the way. You know, and I'm going to raise these kids. They're going to have a father because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you can't tell already, I'm more of a thinker. Okay, I'm an in my head kind of guy. When I was new, I've got analysis paralysis. I related to it's a lot bigger up here than it is out here. You know, all these sort of, it's like the euphemisms in AA that we have for the thinkers. I related to those. I didn't so much, you know, I spirituality never came easy to me. I'm the guy who goes through the motions and feels like he's praying to the carpet. I've had something really wonderful happen in the last year or two, or in the last year. I go to put, Kian is his name, I go to put him down at night. And we have this little glider chair in his room, and I sit in there, I give him a bottle. And when I'm putting him down at night, I pray for him. When I'm trying to get him to go to sleep, I just pray for him. And I'm experiencing a sense of paternity with him. And now my intellectual idea of God is a genderless sort of force or whatever the case. I don't have a religious idea of it, but I've grown up here. I probably have some tendencies toward that. And so I gave God just enough to stay sober, and I haven't been able, but I've never trusted anybody my whole life. Everybody I was supposed to trust walked out on me, abused me, neglected me, didn't do their job. They loved me, but they didn't do their job. It was on me to get it done. You know, when it all came down to it, it was on me. Whether I was going to do it right or not, at least I was going to try the hardest. And so I'm experiencing what it feels like to be in a protective role and to have my arms around him, and to lean into him, and to know that I would take the brunt of whatever it is for him. That I'm not going to be able to. He's going to make his own choices. But whatever I can do, I'm here to do. Whatever he'll let me do, I'm here to do. You know. And the realization came to me in the prayer and meditation of this. That God was sitting behind me. God's sitting behind me the same way he's sitting in my lap, and the same way, and he's sitting down looking on me, and he's looking on us the same way that I'm looking down on this little boy. And I got it. I got it for the first time in my gut. Now, I've been saying don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens for 19 years in this program. And every once in a while I think, oh, there it is. It just happened again. And then this year I get hit with this one. This is the one I get hit with. You know, this is an onion that keeps on going back. You know, I'm not worried every day about taking a drink. There are days that I've thought about it, but that's not what my biggest concern is here. I'm trying to live better. I'm trying to find the best me that there is, and I find that through how I serve my God. And I don't even know how to become of maximum service to God without help and without these steps and without the efforts that we take. I don't even know how to do that. You know, I don't even quite know how all of that works. I just know that it does. I just know that it does. You know, and there was. I'll tell one more story, and then I'm gonna quit. And my phone turned off, so I don't know how long you guys have been held hostage. And it's something about our fellowship. And there was a girl, and I think it's very appropriate for this particular speaker meeting. There was a girl in our young people's group that got sober at 13 years old. She's 27 now. She's still sober to this day, still active in the fellowship. She was 16 at the time that all this stuff was going on. When my sister got murdered, there were a lot of times, I'm sitting in my living room, and I'm kind of in shock. I'm not moving a lot. I'm just kind of sitting there. You know, I'm a little frozen with it. I'm not saying much. There are no magic words. I want to stop hurting, but I'm not even totally feeling everything yet. And this girl comes into my house. She's 16, and I think that her youth, with all of the flaws that come with our age and of us not having maturity or the sense of life yet, I think with it came just enough anxiety that she didn't try to, like, say anything stupid that would really end up offending me. But she had been trained in our program. Her feet were trained. She knew to come in and be of service. She walked into my apartment, and I just looked up, and I saw her. She just said hi, and she walked over, and she started doing my dishes. 16-year-old girl walked over and started doing my dishes. I don't know if that's God. I don't know if that's just a nervous kid. I know it's something that I'll never forget. And I know that whenever I get the chance, I'm going to do somebody else's dishes because it was done for me. I know that's what our fellowship is about. It's about taking our wounded and caring for them and loving them through it and getting them to the other side of it. And so I want to thank the convention committee. I want to thank our other speakers and all of you guys for being here. Thanks.
Let's give all our speakers one more round of applause. All right, I pretty much just said that, so I'm not going to say it again. Thank you for attending this meeting. We will now have Darren B. read a vision for you and lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Darren, alcoholic. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.